Good evening. It's Wednesday night. It's time for The Hidden Work. And we're working our way through the book, The Hidden Work by E.J. Gold. And Ivan has a copy in his hand and is holding it up for you to see. We've been through the first 3.5 chapters. It's not a long book, but it's meaty. It's a very meaty book. And it's worth it. It's worth a stretch for us to take the time to work on it. So we're taking our sweet time to get through the book. Now, Jana, how many people are there? Okay. So what I want to do first is I want to spend just a minute, Ivan, so that everybody can arrive. All right? Does that make sense? I want everybody to arrive tonight. So we've worked very hard to get to this point, and there's a great deal of material that's being offered to us. But I want us to take the time to arrive at this particular event that we're having right now. And so what do I mean by that? What I mean by that is we've been involved in life all day. It's like we've rushed through the door to get here. And we basically have brought, I always call it road dust. You know, we're covered in the outside. And rather than doing that, let's take the time to brush that off and arrive at this event so that the mental chatter is slowing down. And we're beginning to focus on this particular event and the work we're going to do tonight. Because as we've been working through the material in this particular chapter, we begin to see that it's an important effort for us to begin to develop a circle of friends. Do you remember that from last week? So in the work of developing a circle of friends, we're going to call it, we're bringing forth what we have individually to this circle. And by each of us taking the time to arrive to this place, good. There you go. Okay. So once we get here, in a certain way, then we can begin. Because before we've arrived, the material, part of the material, isn't even accessible to us. Does this make sense? Before we can get here, the material doesn't even exist. Because this material, by its very nature, is nonlinear. It's nonlinear, and so we have to get in a space that's nonlinear. If we remain in the world, the material is just not here. It just didn't show up. So we have to show up, and then something's possible. All right, make sense? All right, so where were we? Chapter 4. Where did we get in chapter 4? I'm going to read exactly where we ended. And where we ended was very difficult, actually. We ended on page 30 of The Hidden Work, and we're on the, we read through the second full paragraph. I'm going to go ahead and read that just to reorient to that place, because then we're going to take off again, okay? We're going to reorient, and then we're going to take off again. We may return to this world over again and again, and as you recall, we were talking about eternal recurrence. But nothing in the outer world will change. The outcome will be the same. The machine will say the same things, think the same thoughts, feel the same feelings, and behave in exactly the same way. And, in the end, nothing about the outer life of the machine will have changed. So the outer is not going to change. If we come to it with a involuntarily come forth, and then given to us is the idea that we can voluntarily, do you remember the phrase?
Ascend the cross?
Well, the objective is to ascend the cross, and it's to take on the obligation.
Take on the
obligation. To accept the obligation, to embrace the obligation. And that's what we're trying to do, okay? That's the work here. And we've talked a little bit about what does it mean to accept the obligation. Okay, let's just jump ahead then. Let's see what happens. It is not in the matrix, the outer self of the organic machine, but in the diamond, the being, that real change is possible. So this is an odd thing. In a certain way, no change is possible in the outer. In a certain way, the outer remains as it is. It looks like it's different, this is different, that's different. But that's not where the change can occur. All right? Real change is possible to really see, hear, feel, and sense. Now listen, to have the will to awaken the machine. And I think Simon addressed that about 2 weeks ago. The will to awaken the machine. Let's grab that phrase, okay? Let's grab the phrase of the will to awaken the machine. Let's hold it in the hands for just a moment. The will to awaken the machine, to be able to place, replace, fix, split, diffuse, and concentrate attention directly as the source of attention. To be a functioning, conscious source of transforming, of evolutionary radiation. Think about that. To be a source. Okay?
I have a question.
Yeah?
If you change on the inner and your being, and you are awake in your being, won't that change the outer automatically?
Well, in my view of that is that the outer is not what's going to change, but our view of it will change. Suddenly we look around with eyes that are different, and we see different things that we've never even saw that were actually there. And I believe that at that point we can begin to see like a sense of true creativity.
It just seems to me that you would make different choices.
You would. You would. That doesn't mean that the outer has changed. You've changed, and you find a different path. You've been walking the same path every single time, and suddenly you notice, gosh, there's this little bridge over there. I think I'll take that.
Well, you know, on the other hand, this is quite a good question that Susan is asking, because it's not clear to me that you do make decisions and change things. In other words, that there's in this teaching, there may not be free will in the sense that it's usually discussed in theology and philosophy, because it seems to me the exercise of will and the free will is something more like we've already brought up Groundhog Day, the film, and that this is a very good representation of the eternal recurrence,
mm-hmm.
in the sense that it doesn't just show this character going two times or three times or five times, you know, back through that day. There's a suggestion that it's endless times, or let's say, for all practical purposes, dozens or very many times repeating. And what you see in Groundhog Day is that there's a whole set of very fixed points. It's like what E.J. calls a morphology, there's a sense in which the activity of that day is frozen, or the Bill Murray character, it's set. And but okay, since he keeps on experiencing it from inside over and over again, he keeps changing attitude. Well, it actually does show him. I know there's at least once where he commits suicide by jumping off a building, and then he just wakes up the next morning.
Anyway.
And the day starts over again. But the point I'm going to is that it shares the theme with Uspensky's book, with The Strange Life of Ivan Osokin, is that the thing is, as much as you would like to think that by having a detachment and an awareness, you know, a different perspective on this life of yours, oh, everything will be different. Obviously, I'm going to make different choices, and everything will be different. I think there's a suggestion, you know, both in the Gurdjieff teaching and in what EJ is saying here, that actually there may be nothing that changes, or only very, very subtle elements of that very fixed day or life that you're going through.
Well, I mean, my only thought is that if you were more awakened, you would simply not be interested in, like, the football game or things like that. Not that you're trying to make changes.
Right.
But the football game is still going on.
But no, but let's examine what she's saying. I think this is really interesting because, see, the thing is, Susan, like David is fond of reminding us all the time, we in this circle are sitting here doing this on a Wednesday night, and we're already not watching football games. So the one way to think of that about that is that this is a lifetime that you're having, and I'm having, and Jana and David and Simon and Harry, we're all having this lifetime, and there's a certain plot to it, you know, which happens to include our activities with a school, with an esoteric school. And I think that it's like this is a lifetime we're living where a set of decisions has been made that fairly well rules out football. So now if you're saying whether can I go out, let's say in the grocery store tomorrow or at my job and have an influence on somebody that might be an awakening influence and such that
maybe
somehow they might be weaned away from their interest in football, yeah, maybe that's part of my work with this school in this lifetime.
And I think that's what the phrase in the last paragraph said.
Which is?
Read it.
This paragraph. To be a functioning conscious source of transforming evolutionary radiation.
So you walk into the grocery store, if you go in as a robot, then everything will be exactly the same forever. But if you go in with a diamond being in radiation, not only will you be different, and suddenly this grocery store in a sense comes to life, but somebody else might notice that. That's interesting. That is bloody interesting.
Yeah.
Somebody else might notice it. They've been looking for something. They don't know what. They don't know what or why. They know they've been looking for something, and then they see it.
Yeah. Actually, David, I have a good one. There's another bit of data on that, because I do remember EJ talking very specifically about this specific thing where if you ever go out, if you ever spend any time with him, like going out to stores, like in or sort of what you would think of as ordinary life activities, you might see that he's constantly engaging in conversations and communication with all kinds of people, and this is what he's doing. And I remember him saying once, after going through like a grocery store checkout line and like having this big chat about the weather or you know,
whatever
something or other,
yeah,
you know, with a grocery store checkout woman. It was like I think I was with like three or four people literally outside in the parking lot of the grocery store, and somebody brought up something or other. I mean, they said, like, gee, that was a nice checkout clerk or whatever. And EJ said literally was, he said, well, you know, this is like after a few hundred or a few thousand passes, this conversation that we have may actually be about the work. Okay, so...
For that person.
For that conversation.
Yeah.
So it's like what he's saying is, this conversation that he had with the clerk is part of an eternal fixed plot. I mean, that's, he always, in this lifetime, goes to that store and meets that clerk and has that conversation. So what is it that can be changed by multiple, many eternal, in fact, returns? Well, subtly, at some point, there may be a way to just kick or influence that conversation where it's like, oh, isn't the weather nice? And somehow it gets into, oh, you know, you remind me of my granddaughter and my grandmother, and I don't know, have you ever heard of Awakening the Machine? What's that awakening? I don't know what, you know, I don't know what the change would be.
What the change would be, which is that last paragraph.
Yeah, which is
that there's a that you are able and willing to be in that radiation. If you're willing to be in that radiation, then that's what the person notices. They may hear the words, mm-hmm. and they may be the same words, but it's suddenly something's
that
different.
That may be it, yeah, right.
Suddenly something's
even
different.
Even the conversation may forever
be identical.
The same. Yeah.
But it's what's happening, in a sense, behind the scenes. So can we do our work? And what is our work? Even to the extent that we are immature in the work in a certain manner, can we stand in that place of radiation? Because we do have a sense of what it means to awaken the machine. So can we sacrifice our machine hunger, the habitude of the historical personality? Can we move into the will of attention? And the answer is yes, because we left the road dust at the door, didn't we? And we came in. We came into this room. Now we are in this room.
And there are quite a few comments.
I note that because I want to note the fact that this space is fundamentally different than it was even 15 minutes ago. Okay? So thank you, Susan. Please go ahead.
Okay, so yeah, there's a bunch of comments. Simon says, we are again in the crossroads, but for once we take the other side for a change that we didn't for so many lives before.
The road, yeah.
Go ahead.
Jim says, only when he accepts the circumstances does it stop.
Uh-huh.
Hawk Lady said, maybe it's not our first time taking the other side. Maybe this time we will go much further than ever before.
Okay.
Becky said, Bill Murray changed inside. He appreciated each day more and more as he gave more, rather than expecting it to give him.
Okay.
Yeah, it suggests there's a suggestion of the way of service in that movie.
Yeah. Good.
Jim H. says, I think this is the Sisyphus teaching. Condemned to roll our boiler up the mountain, our boulder up the mountain.
That's very good, because we get to the top and we out of fatigue, we can't make that last foot, and then we begin again. And that might be. That might very well be, Jim. Good point.
Silverdale says, as we increase consciousness, the consciousness of our HBM is transformed accordingly.
Right.
Mark Roach said, and somebody might even be affected by it, even if they don't notice it.
That's correct. Well, they may not consciously notice it. Well, I don't know. Maybe you're right.
I think he's right. Yeah, I think this is what EJ was saying about the clerk in the checkout line, which is, you know, that this person, that he, EJ, is a source of this radiation of transformation of consciousness. And yeah, very seldom does that person know what that is that they're experiencing, but they are experiencing something.
Yeah, but I think Mark's implying I think that clerk noticed that something was unusual or different. They may not have words for it or understanding.
Right.
Is Mark implying that maybe they didn't even notice that there was something different? That might be a bit of a stretch, but maybe not super critical. Is it okay for me to move on to the next paragraph?
Yes. There are some good things, but we'll save them.
Okay. Then I want to actually emphasize this next paragraph, next couple of paragraphs. In beginning work, some will find that self-study, a particular concentration of attention, is more useful to them, whereas the invocation of presence is better at a very beginning effort for others. So, what is this? Why is he bringing this up?
Well, I don't know. That's interesting. I had not noticed that passage before.
Well, I did. So, sports fans, I know you're missing the football game tonight, but nevertheless, are we two camps?
Well, every teacher would know that every student has a different learning style. When you're working with children, some can do it auditorily, some by touch. So, yes.
Some will find that self-study, that a particular concentration of attention is more useful to them, and others call it invocation of presence. So, what do you think is meant by the first of those two choices? Is Silverdale around?
Yes, I am.
And I'm putting that at your doorstep, mister.
Oh, boy. Well, look, we're told that we have an essential self, which is an electrical body, which is dominated by the HBM. So in some cases, I suppose, depending upon our temperament and character, we have to persuade ourselves of that by simply, in the first case, studying ourselves and trying to verify that this is actually the case. So that would be a particular form of concentration for purposes of verification. But for other people, I think women in particular, this is a very easy thing to do, to simply invoke their presence. And,
well, I wouldn't ask about the second one.
Oh, so but anyway, the grass always looks greener on the other side, doesn't it?
I asked you about the first one.
Okay, so...
I wanted to ask Susan about the second one.
Okay, well, in my case, when I ran across the idea that the essential self is an electrical body within my human, which is being dominated by the electrical body in my human biological machine, I had to study myself to figure out how to verify that idea for myself.
Yeah, so there's a certain form of work with your attention that is very profound, and I think one of the elements to it that Simon was talking about and others, and Harry, the idea of the use of the popcorn exercise. You know, that's a form of that that's very, very powerful. But now I'm interested in why is there being a distinction drawn between, and then the invocation of presence? Susan, can you help me, please?
Well, yes. It seems to me the paragraph as a whole is saying some will find that blank is more useful, and the other will find that blank is better for beginning efforts of others. So taking out the details, it's just saying different learning styles.
So in your work,
for me personally, well, I would say different. Like self-study would be more like self-observation, or maybe watching a part of your body, or
yeah,
something like that.
And
which might be easier for me than invocation of presence, because for me, I have to stop my brain from talking. So to just invocation.
What do you do? How do you do that? Do you just say stop?
No, I know. You would like observe your hand for and watch it for 20 minutes and just or something like that would be easier for me rather than just saying, okay, I'm going to invocate my presence right now.
Well, there's a whole book on it.
Yeah, well, that's what the footnote here is about. You know, let me just say, again, Silverdale may have comments to add to this, but, you know, these two things, of course, this is a real echo of the entire human biological machine, because the EJ repeats, I don't know how many times, the tools that the essential self has, the being, is very simple and very stripped down, and it only has a couple of tools, which is to be able to use its attention and to be able to invoke its presence. So, I mean, you know, those are the two choices that EJ's selecting from here. It's either one or the other. And I don't know, you know, it may be just speculating, but it seems to me, again, going with Silverdale, I believe that I started out here in this community with doing a lot of self-study, because I think that when I was younger, when I was just starting out, I had a lot of very unconscious behavior. I think that I was very unaware of a lot of my fidgets and personality, character, behaviors, and so on and so on. So that's what I needed to start out with. And let's say only after moderating, or at least, you know, raising my own self-awareness about some of my own behavior and so on, and maybe being a little more measured ordinarily or just in my everyday
right.
life, then I could turn to also the other tool of the essential self. In other words, going
presence.
To invoke presence, which is also coming from the being. You know, the self-observation is to create a, what would you call that? That's like the beachhead in the other dimension. You know, try to have the being do something in relation to the machine.
Let's see if the next paragraph helps us out of this conundrum,
mm-hmm.
okay?
And also make room for comments later.
Yeah.
The invocation of presence wells up from the higher emotional centrum when no countercurrent of negative emotion interferes, and can empower self-study as exemplified by the process of following emotions of the human biological machine. Now here's the kicker. As a lover would follow every motion of one's beloved, but without a serious application of a highly disciplined force of intense impersonal agape, or adoration, our old friend adoration comes back. Without that, it's completely mental and useless. So here comes adoration suddenly. And now when we talk about the invocation of presence, it's like the lover comes forth. And there's this expression that comes for us to work with. And it's something called adoration. Jumping ahead, and Susan, I noted what you said. Group efforts by themselves do nothing to alleviate the suffering of the absolute. The work can only be accomplished by evolved beings who have assumed the obligation of eternal return. That's what I wanted to get to, Ivan. Working toward the perfection of their own lives by awakening the machine and at the same time performing as a group their daily obligation, work absolute. Go ahead, Susan, but then I have a question for the group, okay?
Okay, just a couple. Becky Sunnybrook, it seems without presence in the first place, attention would not be possible.
Without presence, the attention is lifeless and it's mental. You're exactly right.
Simon is saying This is saying that unless we apply adoration to our active presence, it is a useless action.
I would say that it may not be possible. Now, let's get clear here. We're on the one hand, I'm indicating that this is a group of skilled operatives that show up on this Wednesday night, okay? That we've been down some of the roads. I'm not saying that we're fully evolved and therefore blah, blah, blah. And the amount of adoration may be a teaspoon, but it's something. And what we're doing is we're doing the exercises to begin to develop those things and make them usable tools that we can call on when we need to call on them. That's the point. We need to call on them, okay? So, yes, Becky, adoration is essential to what we're doing. Can I pose my question?
Yes.
Thank you. So it says here, in that paragraph, the work can only be accomplished by evolved beings who have assumed the obligation of eternal return. So I debated, so my question is, have you assumed the obligation of eternal return? In a certain way, I don't mean it theoretically either. I'm aware of that.
And you know, David, a point that I don't think I made last Wednesday, but occurred to me afterwards, was I'm not entirely persuaded that we return to this life over and over and over again. But what I am convinced of is that when we go to sleep at night and enter into that small death, so to speak, when we wake up next morning, we have returned to the same life. And in this sense, we're bound and returned day after day after day after day to the same cast of characters, the things we're dealing with. And it's in this process of attempting to use each day to awaken the machine, transform ourselves, and engage in prayer absolute, again, together with a group of friends, makes the journey even more enjoyable.
And more effective, too.
It makes
it more effective. And so when we wake up from that little death and return to an eternal recurrence to the same tableau that we left the day before, is there a notation? Is one of the programs that starts to run, is one of the apps that is invoked when you reboot the machine, is one of those apps actually called assuming the obligation of eternal return? Okay?
Illustration.
Yeah. So, are there any comments on that one, Susan?
No.
Yeah. And I know it's not.
Well, now there is.
Okay.
Molly says, eternal return sounds awful. That's my subjective feeling.
Okay.
Mark Circa says, if you want a new life, then it's harder to be here now. And it brings eternal life a closer possibility. Guess what, buddy? You cannot leave.
Yeah, well, we passed by the previous paragraph about where the grass is always greener on the other side of the fence. EJ ended that paragraph
right,
saying that all human beings, just like the other members of the monkey family, always only what they do not have, which is to say, you know, you're driven by want or need or whatever primate directives. While those of the work are willing to want only what they have,
see,
which is, that's a pretty
profound
cool statement.
I think that's a cool.
Well, it's It's disturbing if you think about it.
I think it's pretty cool. I think it's a cool statement because who was it that said somebody named Mark? Another Mark?
Yes.
Not Mark Roche, right?
Mark Sika.
Sika?
Circa. C-A-R-K-A.
Circa. Circa now. Mark now. It's like, also another way to look at that is, it's not that you want something, but you wake up and suddenly look at I'm calling it the tableau of your day in a certain way and go, my gosh, maybe I can do this. What about this? It's like, if you're coming from that place of intense or this beginning from your invocation of presence, it's fascinating. It's a fascinating day, and it's a fascinating thing to see what's going to, unfold in a certain way. So, anyway, just take a look at that phraseology in that particular paragraph, okay? This, have you assumed the obligation of eternal return?
And I don't have
to use that phrase. Go ahead, Susan.
Hawk Lady says, well, we have all returned here to this point.
That's right.
Becky Sunnybrook said, it wasn't my decision. Just one day it became real to me.
I don't know about that. It's like, and, George or Silverdale has said to us many times, at some point, we have these two electrical bodies, and at some point there's the beginning of a tipping point where we start to live not from the mechanical self, but we gradually start to live more and more, and the tipping point occurs where we're living in this eternality rather than in this literal, linear self.
Yeah, and I think if I understand correctly, I think this is a very, obviously very profound, very important question, and I'm not sure that I can answer it. I think it's a good question to sit with.
Because
I think that another quality of the tipping point that you're talking about, if I understand some of EJ's very esoteric statements, moderately correctly or whatever, what can happen or what could possibly happen at that tipping point is it changes everything behind it. It makes the if you've made the decision to
accept
the obligation of eternal return. I think seems to me suddenly what happens at that point is you will have eternally experienced eternal return. It's like you will have made it such that from the very beginning of your lifetime, you've recycled it. You've accepted it. Yeah. So it's like saying, I think that there's a situation because of the way EJ talks about time where you're saying this decision, this particular decision, it doesn't just generate your future. It changes your entire past. Because it has to. It would have to.
By
definition, it's going to change your entire past.
I don't know all the philosophy, but I do know that I've recaptured some of my past. I feel like I've recaptured some of it. In a certain way. I've recaptured I've noticed moments of awakenedness that weren't, they were always there. But I'm recapturing those now. And, I don't know, Becky, if it was a decision we made or a decision, but I think the tipping point has started to occur. And what if you, this was a lot that I was thinking about last night, is like, what if the answer to that is yes? You have assumed the obligation of eternal return. What if that was yes? And if it's a yes, how are you fulfilling it?
Well,
how are you doing?
Second part of her second sentence was, it came to me and that was such a great gift that never left.
Where are you reading this?
That was the second sentence of Becky's that I hadn't read yet.
Oh, I see, I see. Yes. Nice.
And what was it? Say it again.
The whole thing said, it wasn't my decision. Just one day it became real to me. It came to me, and that was such a gift that never left.
Right. Nice. Very, very nice.
There's some really good comments coming.
Go for it.
So Molly says, I will learn to work with it somehow by playing with presence in the present, learning to be here more in the moment. Piandro says, can one even perceive the eternal return without already tactfully accepting it?
Correct.
Read that again. I didn't quite get that.
Can one even perceive eternal return without tacitly having accepted it?
Without tactfully accepting it.
Tactfully, I see.
Okay. That's an interesting one.
Okay.
Becky says, it is a play. Even when tough times arise, you can get through, and you know you can.
And you know you do, yeah.
Piandra says, once we see the eternal return, we are bound.
I think that's the thing that's frightening about the concept of eternal return, is that once we sense that we have so assumed that obligation, we are bound in a way. We are bound like the absolute is so bound. We are beginning then to be assume the position on the cross. We are bound at that point.
Yeah, this is like... We're not going to get very far through this chapter at this rate.
I think we can go on.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
No, I was just going to say, this strikes me like the awakening of conscience. You know, it's like the part of the quality would be of the awakening of conscience from the essential self, from the being, what is going to happen to kind of all of these distractions, let's say, going back to the football game, or, you know, the seductions that everyday life has for me. Well, these are going to fade into, you know, and they become illusion. Like the illusion will become obvious as illusion if you have this, you know, as this awakening takes place, it seems to me.
Let's just jump ahead. So that's a question that we should all hold, okay? You'll notice that it's in italics.
Mm-hmm.
Let's hold that question.
Yeah.
Jay talks about group work, people, aptitude for the work. Somebody in the work may take the time, if the work allows, to help a group prepare to assume the obligation of the work. So that's what, in a sense, you know, the teacher has done.
Where are you?
Prepare the ground, in a sense. Go ahead, Susan.
Oh, I asked where you were. I'm sorry.
Oh, I jumped ahead 32. A couple of paragraphs.
Okay, thank you.
After an effective group is formed, everyone else is sent away. And that's more about community work. And so on and so forth. One thing that's important in that next paragraph, it says that one does not join a community with work orientation to attain for oneself a few supernatural powers. And this is something that everybody has to be careful of, that you're not trying to get those powers. They are just they're an accident of that particular kind of work. And then the interface between the teacher and the students. And nothing is guaranteed. And then he talks about the first sign of serious struggle at the end of the next paragraph. And somebody spoke to me and sort of sent an email, and it was indicating they talked about the idea of jumping off a cliff. And what is it that we can do in the context that we are in right here? We're in this context, and we're going to go away at the end of the night. What is it that we can do in this context to put ourselves more at risk for the benefit of more ably assuming the obligation of this eternal return? What can we do? I'm always going to be asking that question of myself and of ourselves here. Do not romanticize the work community or the group work that leads to the work community. Mm-hmm. Group work is for the benefit of the teacher, not the individuals in the group. And we talked about the concept of, you know, like in this particular moment right now, you know, where is that teacher and where is it formed? And that's why I say you've got to come to here. You have to be here. And then something else is there too. So what is that struggle that you hide from and not, let's see if we can share it one to another. And then the next few paragraphs, EJ is talking about the different roles that men and women play. I'm now on page 34.
Right.
The roles that men and women play, and that he says that only women can learn to activate the sanctuary in preparation for prayer absolute, while men are able to perform the actual prayer. Women can produce the exact atmosphere necessary for the sacred space itself. The males produce the exact negative force which sends that active principle of prayer upward. For this, the denying force must be produced in the lower cosmos. Yeah? We're all so quiet.
Well, I think we're... You know, one thing that you certainly can feel, you can feel what it feels to be in the presence of very esoteric teaching. Bolts of invocation that he's talking about here.
The female passive principle cannot become denying force for prayer, but can produce the denying force for activation of the sacred space. Only then, when the atmosphere of the sanctuary, the work chamber, which is to be prepared for prayer absolute and is ordinarily sealed when not in use for this specific activity, has been cleaned, purified, and activated, by which I mean charged with a special force that will serve as a substance which will feed the invocation, are men able to actually use the sanctuary for the performance of prayer absolute? So we can reach and we can sense that working. We may not understand it with our linear mind, but we can sense something about that might ring true, let's say. Not make sense, but ring true. Mm-hmm. There's something about it that rings true in the dance of the work that we do together.
Arya says, yet in each one of us, there is a male and a female force, so it's not just our physical gender.
Okay. Anybody else?
Pianjo says the denying force must come from us, the students, in order for the school to function. True? The question.
in order for the school to function?
Yes.
Okay.
He's wondering, is that true? That the denying force must come from the student?
Yes. Absolutely. From that point of view, the answer is yes.
Okay, that's all I've got here.
Okay. The women also have the function of cleaning and purifying the sanctuary after it has been used for prayer absolute. In the objective sense, women's place is really in the home. In this way, women can become women as they ought to be, and men can become men as they ought to be. Women wish to be liberated from their objective function, and men wish to be liberated from their objective function. Each feels that the other has the best part of the bargain, but in effect, men and women are two sides of the same coin. But who can accept this idea without a great deal of struggle? Both are required for something to occur. Both are required, and then both can do something. Both are required for that sense of sanctuary to come together. And in the sense of sanctuary, then both can travel to a different place. Okay? And Ivan, do you want to comment on the last paragraph, or
some
go for it.
Mysteries to me in the last paragraph.
Keep going. Then
the 99 possible laws or entities to which one could make oneself subject never descend into male and female. So. Anyway, it's interesting. I mean, I think that EJ's talking about, you know, he's not talking about the Ten Commandments here. He's not talking about laws in the sense of, you know, thou, like, thou shalt not kill, or thou, you know, shalt not covet thy neighbor's belongings or something. They're something like what, you know, what are sometimes called archetypes, or, you know, their principles, their tremendous, like, their functioning forces, like ideas in the sense of mental ideas. But so he calls them entities. He says, those who attach themselves voluntarily to these great laws, which are often called by the superstitious name of angels, because their bodies seem to be composed entirely of self-luminous, finer spiritualized matter, and also because they happen not by their own choice to seem to float slightly above the ground. And I'm thinking that EJ may be cracking a little bit of a joke there, because it really sounds to me like ghosts. I mean, but anyway, so, but he's saying that these great laws can be male or female. I know those who attach themselves can be male or female. There is an equal chance for men and women. The absolute is an equal opportunity employer. So I think what he's saying is that, you know, in the invocational work that was described in these previous paragraphs, which is actually, seems to me, it's, again, it's very esoteric, but it's like this must be temple invocation. You know, it's the Delphic oracle type of thing, and you know, invocational rituals and so on. But here he's talking about actually joining yourself, like, transforming or moving up to another dimension from the human. And I think that he's saying that if you succeed in doing that, you're beyond gender, because those entities or those archetypes are operating Correct. As what they are. They are what they are. You know, it's like there are 99 names of God, is another expression of this. And at that point, it's like you've left behind, you know, the issue of what your human gender was. It's not relevant at that point. That's what I did out of it.
So part of the way I characterize this whole last half of this chapter is that what is the process that we're going through in group work here? How do I come to the group work? What do I bring to the table when I enter into this particular space? And what would it mean to come to this particular event? What would it mean to be professionally present here? Present. How do you bring forth your highest skill set to this particular event? Because in this event, the work that all of us are doing together is to create sanctuary. This is occurring. This isn't a exercise to get better understanding and know the material better. In this event, we're doing something together. We're actually doing it together. And I've had various phone calls with a few individuals. That's what we're doing at that time. That's the function. So each moment, we're performing, in a sense, the task that we came together to perform. We're doing that, and each of us brings the particular element that they bring. Are you coming forth to kill a little time on a Wednesday night for an hour or so? Or are you bringing your best to share with a circle of friends? And that's the event. Because when we can find the circle of friends, some of the information that's presented here, we can start to glimmer a little bit of its edge. We can see it a bit. On our own, it's just words. It's just words that are mental and useless, as it was said a few paragraphs ago. But if we can come forth and project and invoke our presence, then something else. How are we doing, Susan? How are you doing?
Good. I'm trying to decide which is just talking and...
Just go for it.
Well, Jim says, Jim H., when our essence is directing us rather than the primate, we are acting right here. We're acting right
here. Say that again. You faded the last part.
When our essence is directing us rather than the primate, we are acting right here.
Yeah, so we're bringing right action to it. That's what I was trying to get to, Jim, and that's good. So how are you doing? And I think we're all doing well. It's a nice little ember that we've got going, so.
There's been a constant commenting throughout the evening on how people can feel the space and how tonight feels different, and even from the beginning.
Good.
So I think that's certainly been felt. And
yeah, that was... that was in part a comment that someone made to me that helped us begin slightly differently.
Well, I think it worked, and I also very much liked how Ivan ended last week.
I think Susan said that she liked very much how you ended it last week.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think, again, that's activating the group, activating the function of the group. Yeah, it strikes me that this is, you know, I don't think that he's explicit about it here, but... You know, again, the way that EJ presents this teaching, I think there's a sense here that you know, instead of having to be, it's like the difference from religion, instead of there having to be the temple and then you can do the ritual, it's like by producing this process, by doing the ritual, guess what? We're in the temple.
We invoke the temple.
Yeah, with the temple, if we raise the awareness and if we invoke presence, and especially if we're doing this as a group, then we're bringing the temple to where we are.
We are creating sanctuary in this through this effort. Now, this is the effort of the invocation of presence. And in the invocation of presence, we bring that forth. And in bringing that forth, we create the actual sanctuary.
Mm-hmm.
It's right here. We have so constructed it. We've taken out a different set of hammers and nails and paint, and we've constructed it successfully. Okay? That's the building. The master builder has arrived to build this, our little temple here. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
It's a little comfortable temple. That's what we've got tonight. And did you want to say something, Ivan?
Probably. Why do you ask me that question?
I could read a poem if you would like.
I was just one question with another.
Yeah, but that's you and your people.
Right.
Would you like to hear a poem to end the evening?
Would we like to hear a poem?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's questionable who wrote this, but it is our light, not our darkness, which most frightens us. We ask ourselves, who am I to be brilliant, gorgeous, talented, and fabulous? Actually, who are you not to be? You are a child of God. Your playing small does not serve the world. There's nothing enlightened about shrinking so that other people won't feel insecure around you. We are born to make manifest the glory of God that is within us. It is not just in some of us, but it is in everyone. And as we let our light shine, we unconsciously give other people permission to do the same. As we are liberated from our fear, our presence automatically liberates others. And I have that from Nelson Mandela.
Okay. When we reflect, and it takes a particular kind of effort to reflect on the space, and I want to suggest that we reflect on the space, and then as the evening ends, and we're going to end it in just a minute or two, I suggest that you attempt to take it with you as well. Take a sniff of it with you and recall it later on this evening, but also tomorrow. Pause at some point during the day. Put a post-it on your somewhere and run into it and just say, oh yeah, oh yeah. I'll remember it. I want to do a little bit of business, though. We're going to do a little bit of administrative business. Don't break the space, though. Attempt to hold it. This is the 7th of November. And then I think next week, when is Thanksgiving? Does anybody know?
22nd.
So in 2 weeks, not next week, but in 2 weeks, is the Wednesday, it's Thanksgiving Eve. Do people want to meet then? Are they going to be traveling? Or should we take that week off? And in Pathworld and Becky, I'm positive we're going to have it. That's the Chapter 5 crew. The workshop starts that night. Yeah.
The question is, when does it start?
I know a couple that are. So should we just take that Wednesday off then, the Wednesday before Thanksgiving?
Aria says we should meet. I think we should take a break. Hawk Lady says we should take a break. Mark says yes, but I don't know what that means. And Jim H. says Canadians are free.
Jim says what?
The Canadians are free. They're not that free. They're working on it, though.
Mark says take a break. And Becky says do the class.
Becky says do the class. Is Pathworld there?
Bianca says take a break.
Thomas.
And Hawk Lady asks what you would like to do. And Adulcim, I can never say that, says to take a break.
Adulcim, probably.
Adulcim, yes.
Adulcim.
Adulcim? Yeah. I'd actually prefer to finish Chapter 5. It's going to take us 2 weeks, but Ivan?
I might miss that class.
Anyway.
Yeah,
right.
I may be traveling myself that evening, so I may miss that class. I'd be inclined to say, sure, have a class, but then again, but it's
easy
for me to say I may not be in attendance.
Well, there might also be people from out of town who have arrived on Wednesday.
Right, we have people coming.
Let's go ahead and have it. We'll have it that week, and then we'll just, if people have to miss, they have to miss. And we'll just, whatever. Okay. So we'll just plow ahead. We'll have the second part of Chapter 5 that week. And then, and Mark, I might have to get someone to help you on Chapter 6. I haven't gotten a response. So, there we go. Do you still remember the space? Or did we get swept away by pragmatism? Probably.
A little bit.
Oh.
So thank you for coming this evening. I'll look forward to seeing you next Wednesday. Good night.
Thanks, David and Ivan.
Thank you, George.